Ernest, what's up? Look, I want to put you onto something that's been making waves in the personal finance world. If you've been relying on Mint to manage your finances, I got some news that might startle you at first. Mint is no more. But hold on, because every cloud has its silver lining, and in this case, that lining is Monarch Money. For those of us searching for a robust, user-friendly alternative, Monarch Money is stepping up to the plate. And from personal experience, it's hitting a home run. Let's get personal for a moment. Managing finances can be a maze of confusion, stress, and time consumption. Believe me, I've been there, jumping from one finance app to another, hoping to find that one platform that simplifies everything. Then came Monarch Money. Its ease of use, powerful features, and sleek design transformed my approach to managing finances. What truly sets Monarch apart for me, though, is its collaboration feature. With money being a top Discord trigger for many couples, the ability to seamlessly manage finances with my wife has been a game changer. No extra costs, just shared goals and clarity. But Monarch isn't just about managing your current finances, it's about building your future. Saving for that dream house, your wedding, or a once-in-a-lifetime vacation becomes not just a possibility, but a reality with Monarch's intuitive tools. It's no wonder the Wall Street Journal held it as the best app for savings growth. Monarch Money represents the next evolution in personal finance apps. It's an ad-free haven where your experience is the priority, constantly refined based on real user feedback. It's everything we've been asking for: intuitive, powerful, and relentlessly focused on user satisfaction. Now, for a bit more practicality, Monarch makes transitioning from Mint a breeze, ensuring you can bring all your tags and categories with you. Its intuitive design, customization options, and commitment to privacy and an ad-free experience make it stand out in the sea of competitors. Look, after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/leisure. That's MONARCHMONEY.com/leisure for your extended 30-day free trial. Earners, what's up? Look, I want to give y'all a little peek behind the curtain of producing Earn Your Leisure. It's a lot more than just sitting down and chatting. It involves meticulous planning, recording, editing, and then promoting each episode to ensure it reaches all of you. And if you picked up any of our merch, then you know there's a whole extra layer of logistics, from inventory management to shipping. Running a podcast is like running a small business. And speaking of business, I know many of you entrepreneurs are involved in e-commerce. You understand how crucial it is to streamline operations and cut costs wherever possible. That's why I want to talk to you about ShipStation, the multi-carrier shipping solution that integrates seamlessly with all your online sales channels. It's all about optimizing your shipping, connecting with expert partners, and freeing up more of your time to focus on scaling your business. Now let's talk about our experience with ShipStation. This tool has been a game changer for us, especially with automating routine tasks. Being able to manage everything from one dashboard and print shipping labels with just a click, absolute lifesavers. Plus, the discounts we get on shipping costs are incredible. Honestly, it feels like we're saving thousands. And as our show and merch sales have grown, ShipStation's robust automation and reporting features have helped us keep up without missing a beat. For those of you who get overwhelmed by order volumes, ShipStation's easy-to-use dashboard is a dream come true. You can import orders from any sales channel, apply shipping preferences automatically, and handle customer service issues right there. Not to mention the savings with up to 89% off carrier rates like UPS, DHL Express, and USPS. It's no wonder over 130,000 companies stick with ShipStation long term. So, are you ready to turn your shipping challenges into growth opportunities? Head over to ShipStation.com and use promo code EARN for a free 60-day trial. Again, that's ShipStation.com, promo code EARN. Start streamlining your shipping and scaling your business today. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Earners, what's up? Look, today I want to talk to you about something that's been on my mind, a real weight on my shoulders. You know, we all have these moments, big or small, that just stick with us. When we don't talk about these things, then they can start to affect our lives in unexpected ways. That's why having a space to express these feelings is so important. I know firsthand the benefits of therapy. It's been transformative for my friends and family. Therapy can help you learn crucial skills like setting boundaries and developing coping strategies. It's not just about dealing with major events. It's also about enhancing your day-to-day life, allowing you to become the best version of yourself. So if you've been thinking about therapy, BetterHelp can be a great option for you. It's entirely online, which makes it super convenient and adaptable to your busy schedule. You start by filling out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And you can even switch therapists at any time if you feel the need without any additional cost. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/EarnYourLeisure today to get 10% off your first month. Remember, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/EarnYourLeisure. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over there now. Earners, what's up? Y'all know I'm big on doing your research, sharing your research, and giving credit to where you found the research. But I always get asked the same question. Where do I start with the research? And the answer is easy. It's our sponsor, Yahoo Finance. Whether I'm tracking the daily movement of my favorite companies, doing technical analysis with their easy-to-use charting platform, or checking balance sheets, Yahoo Finance makes something very complex simplified. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or you're looking for extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. You could actually securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors. And it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. With a community of over 90 million users each month, the real strength is helping you on your way to financial success. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, that's yahoofinance.com. You heard me, yahoofinance.com. Don't wait, don't hesitate. I use it. You should go over there and start using it now.
Working with Jay-Z to build the Reform Alliance to get people out of prison. I was with Jay-Z in a board meeting for the Reform Alliance. Now, I don't mean to be rude, but I know a lot about criminal justice stuff. I'm a lawyer. I've been doing this for 30 years. So the one place I don't have to worry about Jay-Z beating me.
It's a home game for you.
It's a home game for me. I'm not worried about Jay-Z. And this is my territory. So, you know, my team would come up with stuff and we were presenting. I mean, I knew my stuff was tight. I'm like, I'm impressing Jay-Z. I know this dude is proud of him. And after I finished talking, he just was looking at me. Just looking at me. And we've been talking about probation and parole and supervision reform and how we're going to reform supervision so folks don't get sent back on for no reason and change. And he just looked at me. He's just like, how many people in this room were supervised into being better? And the room got dead quiet. We're like, uh-oh. He says, is anybody here? He's not the only billionaire in the room. It's a whole bunch of billionaires that he's helped to organize, all in the room. And he said, did anybody here get supervised into being better? Or did you get mentored into being better?
All right, guys, welcome back. EYL, we're back home. And this is a very exciting episode for us.
Yeah.
We're into politics a lot. My mom's been watching.
Our parents are doing the same thing.
They watch it like it's ESPN.
It's all they watch. I got an argument. Like, we were doing our show, and I would argue, like, you're watching this show more than you're watching your son. And I could do more for you than the people you're watching. Exactly. And so they started mixing it in. But, you know, their daytime programming is politics.
Yeah. So we have the man, the myth, the legend. Van Jones, so serial entrepreneur, used to work at the White House,
mm-hmm.
Just got a huge grant from Jeff Bezos that we'll talk about, best-selling author,
yes,
family man, that should have said that first, and somebody that has just trailblazed. I just found out a story about Prince that I just found out just now, so somebody that has been a leader in thought leadership for a while, and somebody that we kind of grew up watching on television. Mm. So it's always good to actually connect with people that you see on TV in mm-hmm. real life, because it's a weird dynamic. You hear the voice, and it's like, hey, you think they're about to cut the commercial.
We've watched you for so long. I mean, currently on CNN, but even from the standpoint where I went to see you live.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And I didn't realize it was 6 years ago, but brought my mom because she had to see you, and you ended up posting me. This is now a full circle moment.
It is a full circle moment. That was we did the We Rise tours right after Trump had gotten elected. So we were going around trying to gather people up and get people's hearts back pumping. And we got a chance to be at the Apollo.
Yeah.
And Cory Booker was there. Victory Boyd, who's now a rising gospel star, it was her first time on stage. I got to interview Al Sharpton. But the crazy thing about it is we look back and a photograph that I posted had you in it.
This is true.
Didn't know you at all. and also, by the way, it's funny because you're talking about, seeing somebody on TV. It's so much more intimate how I know you guys, because you're in my ear. The podcast is not, TV is like over there. The podcast is right here. You be on the little treadmill or whatever. So just seeing you guys on the elevator, I was like cheesing, because I was like, wow, it's like, and also y'all are much taller and much stronger than I knew.
Everyone sitting down has dropped 6 inches off of our height.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we're going to do our next episode standing up.
Hey, listen, y'all know, intimidate some folks. Like, these dudes in the gym, I'm like, I need to go get some barbells. Y'all are some serious brothers. But,
appreciate it.
But I just want to say, it's such a gift what you're doing.
Thank you.
We've been hearing, we should own, we own your own black man, the bow ties and the bean pies and brother, but we don't know how.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's one thing to wish it or want it or dream it.
The application.
But it's how do you actually do it? And as somebody, I'm now in my mid-50s, I'm just now learning a lot of stuff. And I've learned a bunch from you. I've got a chance to, like you guys have a relationship with Robert Smith and stuff like that. And it's unbelievable how, I went to law school. I went to college. I've raised, children. I got a grown son. And I'm still just now realizing the power of being able to use business for social change, to family change. It wasn't something that was really explained the way you guys explained it.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
So thank you.
We have a lot to talk about, but for anybody that might not be familiar, just want to kind of quickly go over your backstory. How do you get into politics? Worked at the highest level, worked at the White House, and seeing CNN, bestselling author, people see your resume, but they might not know how that actually happened. So how does all of this happen to get to this point?
Ooh, well, yeah, my parents, honestly. I mean,
did you always have a passion for politics? Like, this is what you knew you wanted to do?
Yeah, because I was born in 1968.
So it starts with advocacy side of it?
It started with just seeing what my parents went through. I grew up on the edge of a small town in rural West Tennessee, Jackson, Tennessee. My father was born in Orange Mound, Memphis. Anybody who knows Memphis, Orange Mound is the hoodie hood even to this day.
That's where 8-Ball and MJG is from.
Yeah. So my dad was born there in, real poverty. In 1944, segregation, all that kind of stuff. So my dad saw the worst of it. I mean, just straight N-word, blah, blah,
Jim
blah.
Crow.
Jim Crow, for real. Mm-hmm. People act like that stuff was 1,000 years ago. No, my parents were born in segregation. Not my grandparents, not my great-grandparents. My mom and my daddy were born in segregation. They were married under segregation. Not my great-great-grandparents, my mother and my father. And I watched, he had joined the military to get out of poverty. Now, this is when everybody's trying to get out the military. My dad tried to get into the military, went into the military, became a cop in the military, trying to get out of poverty, got out and put himself through college at a little black college called Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee. And he married the college president's daughter, my mother, because my dad was trying to make moves, right? But automatically, that just creates a lot of tension, because my mom was kind of like the bougie side. Her dad had been a college president, she's an AKA and a Link and all that kind of stuff. And my dad is still trying to get his family out of the hood. Hmm. And pretty much everybody that got out of poverty in my family, one way or the other, got out of poverty on this bridge called my father's back. He, even though he's like working as a school teacher, he's constantly sending money back, trying to make sure people don't get evicted, trying to put, you know, put people into school. He put his little brother through college. He put a cousin through college. And when he died, the picture they put on the funeral program was him standing in front of Yale Law School the day I graduated with hands in the air. And what he was said to me was, you know, you're a ninth generation American. We've been here for nine generations. You're the first one in our family that was born with all your rights. You were born with your, because those bills passed in 1964, 65. Mm-hmm. So I was born in 68 with my twin sister. So y'all were born with all your rights. And look at what you've been able to do in one generation to be able to go to a Yale Law School. So for me, much to his dismay and frustration, I said, well, look, I'm here. I've got the law degree. I'm 24 years old with dreadlocks and a law degree. I want to go. I want to help, you know, people like you did, Daddy. I want to, I'm suing cops. You know, I'm doing, my dad's like, wait, you gonna make some money? Like,
he wanted you to work for a law firm.
Yeah, he wanted me to go, like, it's like, we didn't go through all this for you to go and be just as broke or more broke than your cousins. I was like, no, Daddy, I want to be like you. And so I'm still in my mind for 30 years, I'm trying to catch my dad because he helped so many people. When, you know, at that funeral, it was lines around the block for my father, black and white, because he had become a teacher and then he'd become an assistant principal. Then the NAACP sued our county so he could become a principal. Mm. And so he was like a black principal. Mm. And he took this, they gave him this like little shitty middle school that was like the scary middle school, like three housing projects feeding into it, Jackson Middle. And he turned it from the worst to one of the best in the state. And he got like state awards as an educator. So when he died, there was white teachers, black teachers, white students, black teachers, students. I'm like, this dude started with literally zero and has helped this many people. Now he's put me in a position where I'm leaving Yale Law School. How am I ever going to catch him in terms of what I can do with my life? So I mean, I spent like, you know, 20, 25 years just trying to use my law degree to help people through politics, through advocacy, suing the San Francisco Police Department, Oakland Police Department. We closed five abusive youth prisons in California, you know, building not-for-profit organizations that could actually help people. As a result, I know how to build not-for-profit organizations. I know how to move policy, but I am only just now learning how to build businesses. I'm just now learning how to move capital, because that's really at the end of the day, you know, what the game is about. And that's brand new, not just for me, for my whole family.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, we don't know a lot about. Yeah. We've had maybe one or two guests that talked about the non-for-profit side of creating organizations.
Yeah.
So what are some of those challenges that you faced, mm-hmm. I guess going back to maybe the 90s, mm-hmm. That you actually see that are prevalent still in getting in that space of the non-for-profit?
You know, people come to me all the time now and say, you know, I want to start a not-for-profit organization. They want me to help them do that. I really challenge them. Like, is that what's missing in our community? Like, we don't have enough not-for-profits. We don't have enough charitable organizations. Is that really where the lack is? People say, oh, I want to go to law school. You know, you went to law school. I want to go to law school. I'm like, really? Really? Is that what you think? We don't have enough. We don't have enough lawyers. You know, we've had lawyers going back to Thurgood Marshall. We've had lawyers, you know, we've had not-for-profits. I mean, it's good maybe for your first 5 or 6 years out of school just to kind of like give back and be grounded. But what we don't have is enough people who understand finance and technology. Mm. If you look at how power functions, there's four corners of power in this country. There's Washington, D.C., politics, bunch of lawyers there. I know that world. I come out of that world. But that's one corner. New York City, where we're sitting right now, Wall Street, finance. I don't see that many black people doing that. And so automatically you know something is wrong, because here we have all these black people in politics, public affairs, lawyers, senators, congresspeople. We got a black vice president. We got two black senators. Of the top 10 cities in America, seven have black mayors. Hakeem Jeffries is about to run, all Democrats in the House. I mean, we got a lot of black people in politics, public service, not-for-profit law degrees, but when you get in the train from D.C. and come up here to New York and go to Wall Street, you don't see as many black folks up here. Wait a minute, that's a problem. Then you hop on an airplane, go from New York City JFK, land in the Bay Area, SFO, now you're in Silicon Valley. Technology. Very few of us in that world. Hold on a second. $1 trillion industries being launched.
Mm-hmm.
Biotech, AI, quantum computing. But very few of us there. Then if you leave SFO, pop down to LAX, and you're in LA, Hollywood. Okay, we have a lot of stars, but we don't own the studios. You have very few Tyler Perrys, very few Oprahs. So if you're trying to play a four-corner game of power, and all we have is a bunch of lawyers in the politics corner, but we don't have power in the finance corner, the technology corner, and the media ownership corner, then no matter how well we play the game, we're probably going to lose more than we win.
So it's media,
mm-hmm.
finance, tech,
and politics.
Politics.
Yeah,
those are
yeah.
the four
corners.
Sure, and you can just see it on the map. D.C. is politics. New York is finance. Bay Area is technology. And L.A. is media ownership.
So,
and most black folks are in politics and entertainment, but we don't own... Prince used to always tell me, Van, you're on CNN. You don't own CNN. I'm not impressed, right? That was how Prince would talk to us.
That's how friends should talk to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so you asked the question about it. What I would say is, I think it's time for us to start using business. It's time for us to start using investment. It's time for us to start using the power of the market to uplift our community as our primary strategy, and then use not-for-profits as a secondary strategy. We've been in reverse.
Mm.
We've been primarily trying to go to politics, protests, not-for-profits to fix everything. Other communities, they don't do that. Other communities, they have businesses, and they have a lobbyist to go to the government to help their businesses. Yeah. We mostly have a bunch of lobbyists with no business to help. But that's not going
to
work.
I was talking to somebody, I think he's from Congo, but he was talking about the whole continent of Africa, and he was saying that charity is not going to solve Africa's problems.
That part.
Like billions of dollars has gone into charity and it's not doing anything. He's
yep.
like only real infrastructure and business is going to change the things, because he's like the politicians, they can't get it right.
Yep.
It's going to get mismanaged anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And when he explained it to me, it made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I kind of see the same thing in America,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's why we started our platform, because like you said, I mean, it's not changing anything
mm-hmm.
to have lawyers. It's good to have it.
Yep.
It's good to have social programs. But ultimately, it just kind of keeps you at the same level that you're at.
Look, everybody needs to vote. I'm not saying anything negative about that. But the ballot box is not where you can get what you want. The ballot box is where you can lose what you got. So if you don't show up, you can lose what you've got. So we have to vote defensively to make sure they don't take more rights from us, take more stuff from us. But that's your defensive strategy. Your offensive strategy has to be, what part of this economy do we want to own and control? And, you know, part of the reason I wound up getting that big grant from Jeff Bezos has to do with me trying to figure that out. And it's amazing how one thing will lead to another thing. So I was trying to be a do-gooder, you know, trying to help people who don't have anything in our community. And you meet people, you know, people who see you on TV or they hear about your work you're doing, and they want to come, they want to help. And a lot of times people have money, you know, they're wealthy people. So Felicia Horowitz, who's an African-American woman.
Yeah, it's Ben Horowitz.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Married to Ben Horowitz. Mm-hmm. Andreessen Horowitz is like the big, you know, the biggest investment firm in Silicon Valley, the biggest investors in technology, the most successful in technology. Well, you know, this is a Jewish guy with a black wife. So they understand oppression. They understand what's going on. And so Felicia Horowitz had it as her mission to try to get more of us involved in what's going on in Silicon Valley. And we're right there in California, not really noticing what was going on. So she, you know, MC Hammer and Nas and myself and other people, she would bring over to the house and try to give us game. And Ben would try to give us game. And, you know, we were very hard-headed because, you know, it's like, well, I'm successful. I mean, and she's like, no, you don't understand anything about what's going on in this state. And so over time, I started realizing, wait a minute, like we're sitting here in California where billions of dollars are being made in technology. We're not uploading apps, we're downloading apps. When you're downloading the app, that means when you move your thumbs around, you're making money for somebody else. It's when you upload an app and somebody uses the app you uploaded, that's when you make money. Black people moving their thumbs around, making money for somebody else, that used to be called picking cotton. Okay, so we're like a bunch of digital cotton pickers out here, downloading other people's stuff, making money for them. And so I said, okay, I need to do something different. And then she introduced me to the people who run the Sun Valley Conference. And they invited me there. And that's where all the billionaires go once a year to talk and do deals and stuff. So I show up there with my eyeballs like about to fall out of my head because, you know, there's Zuckerberg right there. There's, you know, all these names that you've heard of. And they're just walking around, no staff, you know, just talking to each other, eating meals. And you start to realize, hold on a second. This is a whole community of people that are billionaires. It's not like one billionaire over there and one billionaire over here. They know each other. They speak the same language. Their kids go to the same schools. And there's very few of us that participated at that level. And so I realized, man, Felicia's really changing things by just even just the exposure. But then I would come out of it and I would feel depressed because like I don't know how this world works. Mm. And, you know, what am I supposed to do? And how is it supposed to? And so you have to go through that whole period of just feeling disoriented and almost like a big dummy. Like I spent my whole life out here like.
It's like the Matrix.
Yeah.
You got to see the other side.
Yeah.
There's a lot to unpack there. I mean, you brought up something that Robert Smith has talked to us about, mm-hmm. about being on the wrong side of the equation.
Yeah.
Right. And so when you're talking about uploading to download, it's two different things.
Yes.
When you broke down that four corner analogy, I'm like, this is brilliant, mm-hmm. right? Because you come from the law.
Yep.
You have entertainment, media, yep. in a sense, where you're Emmy award winning, yep. work for CNN. But you're now seeing the tech sector. Yep. Is this the inspiration now for Yes, We Code? Mm-hmm. Because when I'm hearing, I'm thinking, you've now seen it, but your advocacy is, how do I now invoke change?
Yeah.
And when we think invoking change, it always starts with the youth.
Yes.
And so is this kind of the inspiration for Yes We Code?
Yeah, you know, it is. Yes We Code is something that Prince and I put together early days trying to figure out how to begin to make a difference in that sector. And then it became Dream Core Tech, and now it's Dream.org Tech. I'm now at a place where my visibility into what's going on is scaring me. You start spending enough time with like these tech giants, you know, the people who are really, I mean, they're basically laying the groundwork for a different human civilization. I mean, you think about, you mentioned being a family guy. I have an 18-month-old baby girl, okay? Just to show you how technology is going to change her whole entire life. Her first crush in, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, it's probably not going to be like a pop star or a rock star or a dashing cartoon character. It's probably going to be an AI. It's probably going to be an artificially intelligent being that she can interact with. Mm. Like that's not how we grew up. When it's time for her to have kids, given where biotech is going in 30, 35 years, she might just be able to open up her laptop and design my grandkids. Okay? In 80, 90 years, when she's buried, she might be buried on Mars. I mean, when you look at what's going on with private space flight, when you look at what's going on with biotech, what's going on with quantum computing, which is going to accelerate AI, these people are creating a whole new human civilization with, I didn't say $1 million, $1 billion, these are $1 trillion industries that are just getting started with very little black and brown participation. And so I look at that and I think to myself, okay, first of all, we need to take this seriously, not just, oh, AI is going to take my job. AI is going to, you know, have racist robots profiling me. Okay, that we need to protect against the negative. But we're so oppressed, man, and traumatized and hurt that we're very threat sensitive. Oh, what's AI going to do is going to hurt me. But we are not opportunity sensitive. How can it help me? Right. How can I get on the ground floor? Mm-hmm. How can I experiment with these technologies and build the next Disney on my laptop? How can I actually use this, combine it with what black folks are great at? Look at what we've been able to create with literally nothing. We took two turntables and a microphone and took over the planet. That's not much technology. This technology, as creative as we are, if we're not scared of it, if we say, oh, we're going to grab it, use it, own it, own the future, own the future. And what's amazing to me is to see people who, because they don't come from that oppression, they don't come from that trauma, they just think it's their right to build the future. And we don't. Mm. And so we can't even call it racism yet. Because it's not like we're banging on the door and they're saying no Negroes allowed.
We're not even trying.
If you're not banging on the door.
You don't even know the door to bang on.
Exactly. You don't even know the door to bang on. Yeah. So, you know, it's like, you know, like with Black Wall Street. Like Black Wall Street, we built Black Wall Street and they burned it down. Well, that's racism. But what if we never built it? What if we never even gave ourselves permission to build it? Is that racism or is that internalized self-limitation, oppression, trauma, and pain? And so what I'm saying is, never will there be a bigger opportunity for Black wealth creation ever, ever, ever than the next 5 to 10 years in the technology space. And even if you don't have an advanced degree in AI, there's going to be so many industries that are built around it and built into it. Whatever you're doing, you should be adding AI to it anyway. And to me, I would have never thought this way. But Felicia Horowitz opened a door. I got a chance to meet people I would have never met. Also, you know, Robert Smith. Opened the door. I got a chance to do stuff with him I would have never got a chance to do, you know, working with him and Jay-Z and those guys to build the Reform Alliance to help people get out of jail. I'm doing do-gooder stuff as a lawyer in the not-for-profit space, but I'm meeting all these titans who want to help. And then rather than just writing a check, they're like, here, come here. Let me teach you something, Felicia Horowitz. Hey, let me come here, Robert Smith. Let me show you something. Just being around Robert Smith without him saying anything made me a better person. Just watching him and how he talks to his staff, the level of respect, it's not respect of you better do this, you better do that. He's at this level and he expects you to be at this level. So even if you didn't know you could be at this level, all of a sudden you start, you know what I mean? You just wanna be in the conversation. You coming up with stuff you didn't even know you knew. Like, so being able to be around people like that, working with Jay-Z to build the Reform Alliance, to get people out of prison. I was with Jay-Z in a board meeting for the Reform Alliance. Now, I don't mean to be rude, but I know a lot about criminal justice stuff. I'm a lawyer. I've been doing this for 30 years. So the one place I don't have to worry about Jay-Z beating me.
It's a home game for you.
It's a home game for me. I'm not worried about Jay-Z. And this is my territory. So, you know, my team would come up with stuff and we were presenting. I mean, I knew my stuff was tight. I'm like, I'm impressing Jay-Z. I know this dude is proud of him. And after I finished talking, he just was looking at me. Just looking at me. And we've been talking about probation and parole and supervision reform and how we're going to reform supervision so folks don't get sent back on for no reason and they're going to change. And he just looked at me. He's just like, how many people in this room were supervised into being better? And the room got dead quiet. We're like, uh-oh. He says, is anybody here? He's not the only billionaire in the room. It's a whole bunch of billionaires that he's helped organize, all in the room. And he said, did anybody here get supervised into being better? Or did you get mentored into being better? He says, why are you talking to us about fixing supervision? You should be turning all these programs into mentorship programs. I was like, oh my God. We've been working on this stuff for 20 years. Nobody had even realized you're basically polishing a turd. Like the whole thing from the beginning can never be fixed. This dude comes in, and this was the thing about Black billionaires. You can be a white billionaire and just be smart in one direction. To be a Black billionaire, you got to have genius on top of genius, wrapped up in genius, deep fried in some more genius. So you're going to be smart in so many different directions.
Keyword is deep fried.
Deep fried in some more genius.
My Southern folk.
Yeah. And so, you know, just being exposed to these guys and how they think and how free their minds are, but also, you know, they don't let a lot of BS around them. You know, you have to be like a bionic crab if you're Black. You know what I mean? Because to be that crab trying to get out of the barrel, you have so many people trying to pull you down. And also, you got to put so many people on your back from your community, from your family. You have to be a bionic crab.
Well, that's what, so we talked to Timbaland.
Yeah.
And he was saying that, he was like, you know, do you ever find it weird that like all of our billionaires is like Oprah, $1 billion. At that time, Kanye, $1 billion. Diddy, $1 billion. Jay-Z, $1.5 billion. Rihanna, $1 billion. He's like, everybody's like $1 billion, $2 billion. Robert Smith's an outlier, but even he's at $9 billion. You got random people that you never heard of, $37 billion, $58 billion. He was like, to me, Jay-Z is already $50 billion because he's like, he's so exceptional. There's no way he's only worth $1 billion. Exactly. Like, he won every Olympic medal possible. There's no way that he's like, and the guy, like, just a random crypto guy is worth $15 billion that you never heard of. That's 30 years old. So what you're saying is right and is true on a variety of different standpoints, that the level of exceptional that you have to be as a black person, it's hard to articulate. Because even the successful people, in the grand scheme of things, are not really as successful as they should be.
They realize that this much
underachieved their counterparts relative to the level of success that they've actually achieved, or the influence that they've actually been able to.
It's kind of like the Puff thing. We're talking to Puff, and he's like, guys, I'm in rooms that you haven't gotten to yet, and then I still am kind of the outlier, and I'm seeing things that I can't even explain yet.
Yeah.
Right? And so he's got to kick down doors for us to now come into the room.
Yeah.
But it's a fight that we're looking at him like, this is the highest level. Mm-hmm. For so many years, we're looking at our entertainers and our athletes, this is the highest level, not realizing
until you realize that it's not.
That it's not the highest level.
It's actually like a lower level, honestly. But let me ask you this. As far as speaking to people at the highest level, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
I think he's the third richest person in the world currently.
Today.
Yeah. Today could change tomorrow.
don't bet against him.
Never would
definitely, I definitely would.
And that's divorced, by the way. He's third rich divorced. So that's,
and she is the I think the third wealthiest woman in America.
So it's like you cut his in half. He's still number three.
So I want to talk about this brand, but first, so you were awarded the Courage and Civility Award in 2021. What is that? Can you kind of explain what that actually means? Then we can go into the grant.
You know, Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez, his partner, decided they wanted to give people some incentive for working across the aisle, working with different races, different political people, whatever. And because all the incentives are to not do that. You know, the incentives are the more you can put down the other side, the more attention you get, or you know, the whole game. And so they decided to create this award. It's an annual award. It's $100 million a year. It's not to the individual. So it's not like, I have $100 million, now I'm a rich person. Like,
that's
like,
the first thing they think. Bro, you got $100, let me borrow some.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly. Don't call me.
I got this idea for you.
Exactly. Nobody's ever said that except everybody.
Send you my deck.
Seriously, I'm like, I do not have $100 million. It's not for me. It's for charity. You know, it's to support charitable organizations. Basically, gave me the right to direct $100 million of his charity, charitable dollars, to causes that I believe in.
But you feel fit.
Yeah, I feel fit. With no board or oversight, I don't have to go back.
You're not handcuffed to me.
Not handcuffed, whatever. And it's really radical because, you know, a lot of times these billionaires, when they do want to do some good, they'll set up a big foundation, and then the foundation's going to hire a bunch of people, and they all went to college, and they all have big, you know, student loans to pay off, so they got to get big salaries, and they got to all have laptops. And by the time you finish with all that, most of the money is paying for the foundation. Sure. You know what I mean? And the people are not getting that much.
We need to discuss this in Aruba. 13-day retreat.
Exactly. We're going to redo our mission statement, and we're going to bring in 15 consultants for that. Yeah. And you're just like, could we have 20 cents in the hood? So it was really radical for him to do that. And he also picked Chef Jose Andres, and he picked Dolly Parton, and they're going to pick some more. But what was so amazing about it to me was that the way it came about. I told you Felicia Horowitz, got me in the room. And then I had a TV show called Redemption Project. We were talking to people who were, you know, formerly incarcerated people who wanted to make amends. And a woman named Diane von Furstenberg saw that show. She might be the only one that saw it because the ratings were terrible. But
I watched it.
Thank you, brother. You and your mom keep me alive.
Yo, man, we gotta support each other, man.
Yeah, exactly. So Diane von Furstenberg saw the show. And so I'm in this room full of like gazillionaires. And she walks right over to me. And she says, I love you. I love your show. I want you to meet someone. And takes me by the hand over to Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez.
Where's this at?
This is at Sun Valley. At this one, the same conference.
The
billionaire conference.
App, can you put that on the notes?
Exactly.
So this is like a Davos situation.
Like a Davos type of situation, exactly. World Economic Forum, Sun Valley, these kind of super, super, super exclusive events. And you know, frankly, there's not that many of us there. And when you get there, it's a totally different culture. You may as well be on Neptune. It's like completely different how they talk and how they interact. But instantly, this woman comes over and grabs me by the hand. And she's like the queen mother, which I didn't know at the time, of all Sun Valley. Mm. Everybody loves Diane von Furstenberg. And so all of a sudden, without me realizing it, again, doing good, this woman noticed me and she took me by the hand directly to Jeff Bezos. And it's like people like trying to figure out, like it's like double dutch. People trying to figure out when they can get in and say something. And she just walked, whoop, you should meet this young man. And so because she tapped me on the shoulder, he said, okay. And so we sat down and talked. And the good thing about it was, I was in a good place emotionally. I had some good therapy. I wasn't stressing out. I didn't have a whole big agenda. I didn't expect to meet him in the first place. And so we just started talking from the heart and mentioned that I had left the Obama White House under fire from the right wing, which is a whole other part of my story. And then somebody who was overhearing it said, yeah, Glenn Beck, and started saying bad stuff about people at Fox. And I said, hold on a second, Glenn Beck is my friend now. And Jeff said, what? I said, yeah, Glenn Beck is my friend.
Glenn Beck, you got a good relationship with Glenn Beck?
I do. I don't agree with him on anything politically. But because he had been the person who had been so hard on me when I was in the Obama administration that I ultimately decided to resign. Because,
what happened with this whole Obama situation?
Okay, so I was working for Obama, and I was his working on clean energy and that type of stuff. The right wing really wanted to stop Obama. They just hated him. And at that point, he's the most popular human ever born. You know what I mean? Like, he got a Nobel Prize just for inhaling and exhaling. I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, just, I mean, just literally because he exists. I mean, it's never happened before in the history of the Nobel Peace Prize. 60 votes in the Senate. Pelosi ran the House for him. I mean, this dude is an unstoppable juggernaut. And so the right wing has to figure out, well, what can you do to stop this guy? So they try to analyze him. They can't do anything to him. They look at all his cabinet secretaries, just trying to find anybody with any kind of dirt. So they get all the way down to me. I'm a special advisor. Now, this is a show for business people. Just understand just one thing about politics. If you're going to meet political people, just understand one thing. The shorter the title, the more power the person has. Okay? President? Vice president. See what I mean? So the shorter your title, the more power you have. The longer your title, the less power you have. So if you're secretary of, undersecretary, deputy undersecretary, the longer your title, less power you have. You know what my title was working for Obama? My title.
Green energy specialist.
Hey, listen, special advisor for green jobs, enterprise, and innovation at the White House Council on Environmental Quality. That was my title. Okay, so it's like I was one step above an intern. And yet the media was so fascinated by having this black guy who's from the Oakland area, who's doing all this stuff with the solar panels or whatever. I was mediagenic. So they had to short me down to green job czar.
Czar.
Ooh.
Czar.
Once they said that's I was a czar.
That did it.
That was putting a bullseye on my forehead. And so Glenn Beck then decides, okay, I'm going to get this guy. I found him. We came all the way down to the special advisor level. And here's this one black guy who used to sue cops in Oakland. And I was a fight the power, radical black activist. I make no apology for it. Because when I was in my 20s, they were building prisons coast to coast. They were, it was right after Rodney King. Mm-hmm. I make no apologies for it. I was on the left side of Pluto, and I would have been further left, but I could have figured it out. And I've never hidden that. I've never apologized for it. If you don't like what my politics were, then the politics for the big people should have been different. Y'all's politics was putting us in prison. We don't have to like that. We don't have to go along with that. But now I'm in the White House.
So what did you do? What'd they find?
So they found that I was a left-wing activist. They found that I've been in socialist collectives. They found I was protested, suing cops. They made up some stuff as well. But in those days, you can be controversial being in the White House. This is Barack Obama's White House. Mm. And we were trying to be as
clean,
squeaky clean. And so Obama's people said, we want to stay. We want you to stay. We want to fight. I said, no, you don't want me to stay. I'm going to tell you right now, if you think this little stuff that they have found is trouble, wait till they really start digging. I was at every protest you can imagine. So I said,
that's him. That's him again.
That's him again.
You got to Know Your Man March?
I had the flu.
Obama was, all right?
I think he was.
They made that a big deal.
Exactly.
He's at the Million Man March. A million people was there.
Exactly.
What's the odds?
Yes, I had the flu. I couldn't go. But so... So Glenn Beck used that to they did, I think, 17, 18 shows on me alone.
It's like propaganda.
Propaganda.
You like an extreme left-wing communist.
Exactly. Communist, black nationalist, hate police.
Solar panels.
Yeah.
And this is the guy that has Obama's ear.
Just trying to give us everything. Good energy, man.
They exactly. just made up
exactly. I'm like, just trying to give like solar panels to the hood. And, like, now I'm like, I'm like Stalin or Mao. So I resigned. And it was tough, man. I was, that was one of the toughest things I ever did, because of course you want to be there with him, with Obama. Of course you want to, all your dreams have come true. You're at this pinnacle of power, and the next day you're gone. And I'll tell you something. We had Blackberries in those days. And when I was working for Obama, my phone would literally just buzz. I mean, I couldn't eat dinner. I'd be in the shower, come back, 30 messages. I mean, it was just buzz, 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 buzz. And after I resigned from the White House, I was like,
it's over.
Is my battery dead?
Like, new number, who this?
Is my battery, is something, did they cut me off? Did we pay my AT&T? I mean, nobody reaching out. And so Glenn Beck literally called, said, I have scalp number one. Van Jones is scalp number one. I'm going to get more.
What's scalp number one?
Like, I took his scalp.
Oh.
He
told you that?
No, he said on the air to the whole world. And so now I'm talking to Jeff Bezos about my life. When this story comes up, somebody who knows said, yeah, and Glenn Beck, took him out, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah. And I said, hold on. I said, Glenn Beck is a friend of mine. And Bezos said, what? I said, yeah, he's a friend of mine. He said, how is that possible? I said, look, I had small children at that time, and I didn't want them to feel that there was some mean guy named Glenn Beck that hurt their daddy because we don't agree on stuff. So I reached out to Beck, and I said, look, I don't care about the public stuff, but you and I need to sit down and talk man to man. And he was shocked to hear from me, and we sat down, and he acknowledged that of course, a couple of years had gone by. He acknowledged that... he would have handled it differently if he had to do it over again. And that was enough for me. So I'm telling this story to Bezos. And Bezos said, I don't think I could do that. I really don't think I could do that. He said, I need to get to know you. He said, that's very interesting to me. And so we just started talking about redemption. I said, listen, man, I go into prisons where young brothers have literally killed other young brothers. And I don't block their blessing from me based on that. They've sold poison to our children. And if I'm going to relate to you based on the worst thing you ever did, we're going to be stuck here forever. I say to those same young brothers, tomorrow's more important than yesterday. What are we going to do? How can you be great? Now, if I can go into prisons and do that, then I look like a big phony. If I then say, but only if you look just like me, only, no. You voted for Trump, I disagree with you. You sold drugs, I disagree with you. You're on right-wing radio, I disagree with you. But beyond the disagreement, there's something in you that God loves, because you wouldn't be here otherwise. Mm. There's something in me that God loves, I wouldn't be here otherwise. So if I'm going to say I'm a person of faith, a man of faith, if I'm going to raise children, in this faith, then I need to be able to show up. It says, love your enemies. It didn't say love your homeboys. It said, love your enemies. It says, pray for those who despitefully use you. It doesn't say pray for your mama. They know you're going to pray for your mama. You got to put that in the Bible. It says, pray for those who despitefully use you. Now, if that's the faith, and I'm on a public stage, and somebody does something that's despicable like Beck did, and I can't forgive him, and I'm not willing to reach out or whatever, then, you know, I can't claim my faith. And so it created this relationship. And then between me and Bezos, not based on religion, but just based on, he was just shocked.
Earners, what's going on? Listen, EYLU is relaunching, revamping, retooling. That's right, we're creating a new educational experience that's more expansive. Shotty, tell them what we got.
Yes, 2023. We got a lot in store, a lot planned for you guys. So you know that EYLU already includes monthly financial planning calls with me, book club calls with Troy, real estate calls with MG the Mortgage Guy, access to the Home Buying Blueprint, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Part of the revamp will include 27 local chapters from across the United States, live interactive teaching, hands-on, not just pre-recorded videos, plus 15 brand new curriculums.
The biggest just got bigger. Head over to EYLUniversity.com. That's EYLUniversity.com. See you there.
I'm serious about this stuff. And then Lauren Sanchez, his partner, you know, she's Latina. She comes from the same communities that I'm talking about. And I think it really moved her to see somebody like for real fighting. And by the way, because I didn't hold all these Republicans in a negative light, I was able to work with them later on, a bunch of other stuff. And anyway, you know, pass bills, stuff like that. So at the end of the day, how did I get the $100 million? At a black woman therapist, black woman, Felicia Horowitz, who got me in the door, a Jewish woman, Diane von Furstenberg, who brought me over to Jeff, and a Latina, Lauren Sanchez, who said, we need to do something with Van. So like, not just talk about it, but do something. And so that's the other thing that people need to talk more about. It's often women behind the scenes that are making a way for men, that are opening doors, that are helping out, that are seeing more in you than you see in yourself, that are giving you these opportunities. And then, okay, well, now you see Van Jones and Jeff Bezos shaking hands on stage. There's a whole lot that went on behind the scenes to make that even possible. And then also doing that inner work meant that when I had the conversation, I wasn't having a conversation about, oh, I'm a victim, I was discriminated against, I was mistreated. I had a conversation about possibility and redemption and forgiveness, which I think is the universal language of love that can create all kinds of miracles. It certainly did in my life.
So what's the goal for the fund now, right? The 100 million is there. And I would, you know, especially in our community, when anything is awarded, there's a microscope. What are you going to do? When is it going to happen? How fast can it happen, right? Where I don't think with the chef and Dolly Parton, it's going to be a similar situation.
True.
So do you feel that type of pressure or angst when it comes to it? And what are the plans for it?
Look, I immediately just almost had to turn my phone off because so many people, you know, they didn't bum rush, to your point, they didn't bum rush the chef or Dolly, but they definitely bum rush me. I want to use the money to disrupt the incarceration industry as an investor, as a philanthropist. Like I'm changing even before your eyes, you know, from being an advocate, a lawyer, a not-for-profit guy. I see myself now more as being somebody, I'm not trying to move Congress, I'm trying to move capital. And I'm trying to move capital into companies that can disrupt the prison industry, that can disrupt the pollution in our communities, that can disrupt poverty. And so, you know, the plans for the money, you know, like there's, you know, I think we did an article about it recently, but, you know, we built an incubator to help companies that want to disrupt the incarceration industry. The incarceration industry is an $80 billion a year industry, $90 billion every year just to lock us up. There's zero alignment of financial incentives for anybody in that industry to help us. It's only to help hurt us. So for instance, if you're a warden of a prison, public, private, I don't care. You have 10 guys in your care for 10 years, $100,000 a piece. I'm not good at math, that's a lot of money. Okay, so you spent that much money locking these 10 guys up. If they leave on Friday, and God forbid all 10 of them kill somebody and they're back in your care Monday morning, you don't get fired. Nobody asks you, wait a minute, you spent how many millions of dollars on these guys? And they didn't do any better than that? You don't get fired at all. Or better case scenario, suppose a year from now, all 10 of them win a Nobel Peace Prize. You don't get a raise. You don't get a promotion. You don't get a thank you. There's no alignment of financial incentives at all. Mm. You're in charge of all these people, and no matter what happens, you're going to have a job. And in fact, you'll get more money if they keep coming back.
Right.
So that's an incarceration industry. Well, hold on a second. Now that I have more of a billionaire perspective, I'm looking at this industry. I say, well, hold on a second. They disrupted the taxi industry with Uber and Lyft. Different technology, different model. They disrupted hotels with Airbnb. Different technology, different model. They disrupted all of retail with Amazon.com. Different technology, different model. They disrupted the whole dirty energy thing with solar panels and electric vehicles and wind turbines. Different technology, different model. How come nobody's tried to disrupt the incarceration industry? The industry that does the most damage to our community, that makes the most money off of our pain and suffering, that continues to produce over and over again repeat customers through a revolving door, and nobody's tried to disrupt it? Nobody's spent a penny to disrupt it? Nobody's created one incubator to put companies together that can say, give me that sister, give me that brother. I'll educate them. I'll get them better nutrition. Nobody? That's my job.
So what kind of companies would disrupt the business system?
Okay, so for instance, we built an incubator. There's a company called Rasa that we invested in. And we can do that because we just made it as a program-related investment. So I'm not making money off of it, but the fund, you can return money to the fund. So it's not Van Jones making money. But this company called Rasa, very simple. Take something like prison, like expungement of prison records. Okay, in the states where that's allowed. Well, if you get your record expunged, you can get any job in the world you want to. If you can't get your record expunged, you're going to be stuck in a low level, which is why a lot of guys wind up going back to what they were doing before because they can't make no money. So that's a part of the revolving door. Well, why don't people take advantage of expungement? Because you have to hire a lawyer and spend $3,000 to $4,000 to get your record expunged in the states where that's allowed, which means rich folk get their records expunged and poor folk don't. So we put money into a company that has an app that can get your record expunged for $500 because they just basically, you know, use AI and just automate the whole thing. And so we, by reducing the cost way down, now way more people can get their records expunged. And so, but nobody wanted to bet on that company. Like, what are you talking about? Like, is that even a thing? There's a massive market there, but nobody wanted to invest in that company. So that's a company. Now they will, they're practically printing money now because somebody can change their whole life. Even, you know, you can do a GoFundMe now and be able to do that in the states where they're operating. There's another one, used to be called Khan Connect. It's basically LinkedIn, AI-powered LinkedIn for formerly incarcerated people. Because what happens is you come home, they say, okay, go get a job. Well, you only have so much, everybody's got only so much energy in their little battery. Even the Energizer Bunny eventually runs out. How many times can you go and apply for a job and get no, 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 before you give up? But with this company, they changed the name recently, but it was initially called Khan Connect if you want to Google it. They use AI to figure out very quickly, okay, if you got a home invasion thing on your record, you're probably not going to be doing cable installing, okay? So there's certain things you're just not going to do. So they figure out very instantly, based on your record, based on what you want to do, where are they hiring? And so it radically accelerates the process by which people leave jail and get a job. But because it turns out, formerly incarcerated people, if they get a job, they're very loyal. So it's actually to the benefit of the employer to get people from that population because they don't feel they can just go quit and go get 12 more jobs. So you're going to save a bunch of money hiring people coming home because you're not going to have to replace that person. Mm-hmm. So it's a benefit all the way around, but using technology to get a win-win-win for the employer. So these companies did not have an incubator, didn't have that kind of help, so we built that for them. So people are like, well, what are you doing with the money? I said, guys, I could just pass the money out and just give everybody a book bag. You know what I mean? Like
turkeys.
You know what I mean? I mean, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that.
The give back.
You know what I mean? And everybody, oh, it's so wonderful or whatever. I can take a bunch of pictures with a bunch of kids or whatever. But then the next year, the money's gone and the kids need another book bag.
It's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable. Yeah. And so.
And we have plenty of those.
And by the way, there are other people that can do that. And so I've taken a lot of heat from people like, well, what's he doing with the money? What's he doing with the money? The good thing is, I'm 55, I'm not 25. I've had 30 years to watch a lot of stuff fail, some of which I was doing, that we thought was gonna have a good outcome, didn't have a good outcome. And it's good to be in my 50s now. I'm not working on my resume. I've got a great resume. I'm working on my obit. I'm working on my obit. What did I do that really made a difference, whether I got the credit for it or not? What did I do that, like my father, you know, he really made a difference. I still can't go home without somebody come up to me in the convenience store, the Walmart. You Willie Jones' son? He used to beat my ass with a paddle. You know what I mean?
The type of difference maker we need.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So for me, like, I take this very, very seriously. If there's some way for us to, so then if we bet on these companies and they do well, we get the money back, we can bet on another one. Yeah. I'm trying to build.
So it's like a VC model.
VC model.
That's what you're implementing.
VC
model. How much money have you distributed so far?
We still have more than half the capital.
Yeah.
Okay. We still have more than half the capital.
And does it start every year? It's the same investment? Or is it just 100 across the board?
No, I have 100.
Lump sum.
Lump sum. And if I haven't deployed all the capital, all the initial capital in 10 years, which now is in 8 years, then it goes back. So basically, here's $100 million. You have 10 years to figure it out.
Is the money growing? Is it an investment or is it just?
Well, we'll see.
I'm saying like the 50 that you haven't spent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's all in you know, stocks and bonds, that type of stuff. But the stuff that we're making bets.
Yeah.
And listen.
So all your money is going into companies. Into private companies. You're not putting money into like programs.
That's the center of the bullseye. But my real game I'm playing has to do with how can I manipulate financial incentives to get better outcomes for our community. That's the real game I'm playing. So if I can figure out financial incentives for people to use technology to help people come home from jail, I'll play that game. But here's another game, which is not a business. There's a brother named Pastor Carl Day. In Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I mean, they call it Killadelphia for, you know, a reason. And it's not like it was when I was coming up. People aren't killing each other over turf and drugs, like, you know, Percocets. Like, the drug trade is not what it used to be. It's pills and Percocets. It's not, people are killing each other over just disses. Oh, you know, somebody posted something on a Instagram or TikTok and so it's a lot of just random chaotic violence because people just don't have much direction. And I met this guy, Pastor Carl Day, and he's just a genius. I mean, he's, you know, formerly incarcerated, you know, found, you know, God in prison, came out. He's like the pastor of the hood. And when you know, gunfire goes off, grandmoms will call him before they call the cops.
Where's he at? North Philly?
All over Philly. In fact, he's one of the few people that can be all over Philly. Mm. And that's the crazy thing about him. He's not turfed out anywhere. Everybody respects him. And so I was talking about what he was doing, and he educated me. You know, he said a lot of these anti-violence programs, they're not even touching the kids who are violent. They might have 500 kids in the program. These are like B students, you know what I mean? They haven't been violent their whole life. And then they're hiring people who went to college with whiteboards and stuff who also are not violent. So the big programs are basically getting B students after school activities and paying off student loans for college graduates. But if a truly violent kid walked in there, they call the cops. You know what I mean? So he's like,
we didn't go to school for this.
He's like, hey, listen, it's like I'm trying to go see my grandma and stuff. You know? So it's not honest. But this dude is talking to the actual cats that actually have their hands on guns, who are actually doing stuff that everybody's scared of. And he said, if I could just have 100 days with these guys, I could help them turn their lives around. I said, well, what do you need? He goes, I need to be able to pay them. I said, what do you mean pay them? He goes, well, look, these college kids are getting paid on violence. Everybody's getting paid on violence except for the violent people. We want to have $1,000 spent to talk about, $100,000 or $1 million to talk about the people talking about the people talking about the kids, and nobody's talking to the kids but me. I said, you know what? Let me make a bet on you. So we wrote a substantial check for him to start a pilot to prove that at a lower dollar amount, he could save more lives. So what he did was he just went to the guys. He knew who they were. So I'll pay you to come off the corner. I'll pay you to sit down here with me every day. We're going to go through this 100-day plan. We're going to do all this self-improvement, anger, all this sort of stuff, and you can get an actual job. And the crazy thing was, you know, one of the guys was like, I can't get a job. And Pastor said, what do you mean you can't get a job? He goes, I can't get a job. Well, you know, you got a criminal record. Like, no, I can't get a job. What are you talking about? He goes, if you got me a job at Subway, my ops would drive by and see me in there, and they'd drive back by and shoot the whole place up. I can't get a job. What are you talking about? Pastor said, warehouses. What if we got you a job from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. in a warehouse? You get paid that way. The guy said, I'll do it. 88%. Well, first of all, 97% of the kids who went through that program are employed or have their own LLCs. 100% of them registered to vote. They all have their driver's licenses or whatever. The 3% is the one kid that got killed. Okay. So it's really life or death like that. But what we were able to demonstrate was incentivize peace. If these are the people who are having the problems, put the money in their pocket, pull them into a program, help them out, get them a job as appropriate. Now these folks are, they're employed, they have their own businesses, they're using their leadership in a different way. And it was radically less expensive than these other programs that literally are just counting the number of noses of people that they talk to. We had 100 contacts with troubled youth. Contacts?
Yeah.
That's not saving any lives. So again, what's the game I'm playing? I'm trying to figure out, okay, can I change the financial incentives on the street? Incentivize you to invest in yourself. Don't yell at you and tell you what you should do. Incentivize you to do it financially.
It's like somebody said something like, you know, they got a scared straight program.
Yeah.
And the idea is to take kids to jail and to scare them.
Right.
So they don't go to jail. But it's like, instead of trying to scare somebody, why don't you try to inspire them?
Yeah.
So instead of taking them to jail, take them to corporate, take them to Africa, take them to different things where they can actually expand their horizons and, like you said, mentorship and have provide, as opposed to taking them to the worst place possible as a deterrent to not go. And once you said, and like you said, most of those kids that are going to scare straight aren't even kids that's going to jail anyway.
Exactly.
They came to our middle school and it was like a permission slip. I'm like,
like a field trip.
I'm not going to go home and ask my parents, can I go to jail? Like, this is just not going to work.
Yeah, it's not going to work at all.
And one of the percentages that are very important and that you ran off, because the program you just described was Beat the Block.
Yes, Beat the Block.
50% of the people are starting their own business.
Yes.
So that changes it. And so now I'm looking at this as an ecosystem that you've built, right? We got the Reform Alliance, you got the fund, which is creating an incubator for technology, and I got a question about that.
Sure.
But you also have another system that's keeping people from going to the system.
Exactly.
And so on your vision board, is this how you planned it? Or are these things happening and I can improve on this, I can change this, I can change this?
I'm learning as I go. I didn't understand a lot of things, man. Like that's the question a business person would ask, right? And I didn't know to think that way. You know, when you come out of kind of rapid response mode, grassroots mode for 30 years, you just kind of like, oh, here's the opportunity. You aren't thinking in a business way. And so in the 2 years that I've had the grant, I've actually realized, okay, some stuff I'm doing doesn't make sense. Like that's not the right way. I've had to bring in different advisors. So I wish I could say, you know, if I was a dishonest person, I'd say, yes, you know, I had this master strategy. I was going to build this ecological. And it's like, no, it was like I met some people that I thought were, frankly, deserving of a bigger bet than they were getting. And then I learned now, though, you know, there's a machine that needs to get built. It's going to take 10 years to build. It's going to take a lot more than the little, you know, money I have. But I'm beginning to see a kind of a jobs, not jails machine that needs to get built. And there's a way that there can be some philanthropic stuff. There can be some VC stuff. There can be some enterprise. There can be some technology. All the stuff I was doing with protest signs and lawsuits and voting campaigns when I was in my 20s and 30s, I think I can better do in my 50s and 60s with capital and building a machine that can take some of those young folks out of Pastor Carl's Beat the Block program. Wouldn't it be amazing if we could move them? Okay, now you're not in trouble anymore. You start your own little company. Now we put your company in an incubator. Mm-hmm. Now we take the incubator. Now we can pass you up the line. Okay, now you're going to Sun Valley. Okay, now you're going to Davos. Right? That's what I want to do.
Yeah. Well, let me.
Can I just follow up really quick?
Mm-hmm.
Because it happens in Philly, mm-hmm. but it also can happen in New York.
Yes.
It can happen in Baltimore.
Yes, once we get the pilot.
Right, once the pilot is. The incubator part is interesting because and this is something that we've seen from private equity and VC, finding companies that we can actually put in the pipeline.
Yeah.
What's the challenges there, right? Are we find, because a lot of times we want to invest in people that look like us,
yes.
but we have to have people that look like us that are creating the companies that we can invest in.
Yeah.
So it's the duality there, it becomes a struggle, right?
Yeah, as an investor, you know, the pipeline problem is the biggest problem. Like, how do you find great companies that somebody had already put all the money into? Like, you got to find a great company right before they're going to prove themselves. You can get in. And then you got to be able to support those portfolio companies so that they can actually meet their full potential. And the thing is, once you put the money in there, you know, it's kind of like different between dating and being married. When you're dating, you're getting all the good news, your diligence process, you're doing all you can to try to figure out what's really going on. Once you put the money in, then you find out what's really happening. You're like, oh, Lord, like, we got a bunch of problems to fix and clean up. We need to bring. And so I'm learning, man, like how you do this. But part of the pipeline problem that is solved for us on this incubator, because there's a sister fund called the Decarceration Fund. And they've already diligenced, I think, 100 plus companies. They wound up investing in about 5. We invested in 4. So right now we're kind of surfing along the back of their diligence process. Mm. But because we can bring capital, then, you know, it's a good partnership there. But these are the type of problems that you get into. Very few social change entrepreneurs like myself have had access to this much unrestricted capital to play these games with. To make these kinds of investments and moves, and so I'm learning a lot.
Can we talk politics for a minute? Mm-hmm. So, super PACs is something that I think is very interesting, and I think I was having a conversation with one of my friends, and you know, I feel like amongst young people, there's a strong disbelief of the political system because mm-hmm. they've seen black people vote for a long period of time, mostly Democratic, mm-hmm. and not much has really changed, or the socioeconomic situation has definitely not changed. It probably even has gotten worse. And so a lot of people have the frame of mind that voting is a waste of time. Mm-hmm. And I was saying that I don't agree with that, but I understand it, because just voting just for the sake of voting is not beneficial, with no economic power put behind it. So we interviewed a congressman, and he was saying that when he first got elected, from the first day he got elected all the way to the time that we interviewed him, he's gotten calls every single day from super PACs. Everybody, from the Israeli super PAC to mm-hmm. the pro-abortion super PAC to the pro-life super PAC. Everybody's giving him, NRA, everybody, right? And he's like, the only people that he's never gotten a phone call is a black super PAC. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there is any black super PACs. So talk about that, because I don't think that people are even fully educated to understand the importance of that and the economics behind the politics, which is actually, in my opinion, more important than any other aspect of it.
So this is complicated, because there's two different ways that politicians get approached. They get approached based on issues. Stop police brutality, we don't believe in abortion, that's issues. And they get approached based on interest. Okay, I'm a coal company, I need you to pass laws to support the coal industry, my economic interest. I'm a solar company, I need you to pass stuff to support the solar company based on my economic interest as a solar manufacturer. For most communities, most ethnic groups, frankly, they spend most of their money on the second one. Like, they go and they say, pass tax breaks to help my business. TAC passed regulations that will help my business. That's what 80% of politics is. We don't have a coherent strategy as Black people to know what industries we're trying to protect. So for instance, suppose we decided, well, you know, Black people are going to own all of AI-related entertainment. That's what we're going to do. We're going to focus on that. We're going to launch companies based on that. We're going to make sure that our entertainers and our athletes are all built into that. That's our industry, is entertainment meets AI. We're going to build the Disney of that. We're going to build the Motown of that. Okay, now, when you call a politician, you're saying, look, pass this law just to protect this industry. I'm going to make a ton more money than I would have, and I'll give you a donation. Mm-hmm. The fact that no Black people can do that gives you a sense of how bad our strategy is. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to pick. Like, remember when the, I hope I don't piss anybody off. But you remember when the Ethiopians, like, every time you went to a parking garage, it was Ethiopians? I don't know if that was just in California. But there was a time when they had just targeted, like, parking garages.
It was like the hotel and motel industry with Indians.
Yeah. You pick something, and then you dominate that, and you protect that politically, and then you start putting your kids into, you know, different schools and whatever, you branch out from that. Our problem is we never have been able to figure out how to dominate where we show up. So we show up right now in the entertainment industry. That's really where we show up the strongest.
In sports.
In sports, yeah. Yeah. So sports, music, entertainment, film, that whole thing. So all of our, so the LeBron comes out of that, Jay-Z comes out of that, Tyler Perry comes out of that, Oprah comes out of that. That's where we are, have been able to dominate. But there are other sectors and other industries that we could dominate if we decided to do it. So I just want to point out, the mere fact that we're talking about a super PAC for issues, for Black issues, and not a super PAC for Black business, I would say.
So it's not a super PAC for reparations. It should be a super PAC for the music industry to protect the artist. That's more beneficial than trying to do a social issue.
I would say that we should at least have a double barreled approach. We need to do a better job of getting government to help our businesses. That's all I'm saying. Government should be helping our businesses. Government should be helping our entrepreneurs. And, you know, not saying that people haven't thought about that and tried, is difficult, but that's going to give you more of a return on investment. That said, issues matter too. And we should organize our money better. And I believe Charles Phillips and some other guys were working on that the last election cycle to try to organize Black money around Black issues. It's true, if a politician, they need two things. They need money and votes. Black people show up saying, we'll give you votes. White people show up saying, we'll give you money. And so—
So they use, here's my thing. I'm a registered independent.
Good.
I lean towards democratic social mm-hmm. issues, pretty liberal. Mm-hmm. I lean towards Republicans when it comes to the economy.
Yeah.
I personally feel that the Democratic Party has used Black people to get votes. Because like you said, we have a lot of numbers mm-hmm. in key states, so that they pander to the votes. They go to like churches and sure. they do the whole thing. But then that's it. It's like, we just get the votes and that's it. Like you said, other groups will come with money. Mm-hmm. So we need your votes to get elected, mm-hmm. but then we're going to actually cater our policies to the people money. That's giving us the money. Mm-hmm. Everybody's kind of in on it. The people that's giving them the money probably know that as well. Only people that's kind of left out in the whim are just Black people, because they're just left hopelessly voting over and over again, because it's been drilled in our head, like, this is our pathway to succeed. It's like going to college, right? This is our pathway to succeed, until you realize, damn, well, I have a liberal arts degree. Mm-hmm. I'm unemployed. I'm 30 years old, and I have $100,000 student loans.
Right.
This didn't work out the way that they told me it would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look, I mean, I'm going to shock you and say I don't disagree with anything you just said. Some stuff is... frankly, white racism that gives us certain outcomes. But some stuff is bad Black strategy. Like, and it's sometimes hard to know where one starts and the other stops. We should be much more strategic in how we vote and who we support. When you create a situation where one party can just take you for granted and the other party can just write you off, then you lose leverage. And so it's important that we actually, and you know, Diddy and other people, I'm not the only one that said this, it's important that we are a lot smarter. What I will say is, as bad as things are for us, if we stop voting, they will get worse. That's why I said, you don't vote to get what you want. You need business for that. But if you don't vote, you can lose what you've got. And so we do have to continue to vote. Now, listen, people want to vote for Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Green Party. I don't care who you vote for. But you do need to vote, because my view is, people say it's a waste of time. It's not a waste of a lot of time. It's like a waste of an hour or two, which you're probably going to use. You know, you probably spend an hour on your social media today. So it's not a waste of that much time. But I think it's important. But here's what I would, I want us to have a strategy. That's what's missing. And the strategy can't always be about who's going to be the president or the mayor. That's only going to affect so much. It can get a lot worse for you if you have the wrong one. But it's not going to get that much better for you if you have the right one, if you don't have other stuff in place. That's why you guys are so important. We have to put other stuff in place. And by the way, if we build a black business class, there's going to be a lot more black conservatives, because you're going to have a lot of black business people going to want to vote for the party that's more for business. So we're going to have a little bit more political diversity in the community, and that's okay. But but here's the thing I'm concerned about. Just go back to what I said at the very beginning. If we're going to have a new human civilization with all this new technology being built by people who don't look like us, trying to solve problems that are not our problems, making money off of stuff that, you know, is never going to come back to our community, that's a big problem. That's a big problem. That's a multi-trillion dollar problem that we can't vote our way out of. Nothing good happens for black people on accident. Nothing good happens to black people accidentally. It requires planning. It requires persistence. It requires purpose. And in this century, the last century you can vote and protest and maybe you'll get something done. In this century, you're going to have to launch businesses. You're going to have to attract capital that's going to use this technology to help us either get us more money or solve our problems. That's what I'm trying to do. We have problems with the criminal justice system. I want to launch businesses. I want to move capital that can disrupt that whole industry. I want all $90 billion that's supposedly being spent to keep our community safe. I want it in the pockets of black entrepreneurs who actually can keep our community safe. Like, and until that happens, I'm not going to stop. That's different than saying I want to outlaw police brutality. Mm-hmm. It's a different conversation. I'm going to build a set of business interests to fight the other business interests and then use government to support my business interests over theirs. We've never done that before. And so if we can take our political genius, if we can take our entertainers and our cultural influencers and then put the business people at the table, erase the chalkboard, how we used to do it, and design that strategy, we can win.
Yeah.
And voting will be a part of it. It just won't be the only, it'll be a smaller part of it than it used to be.
Extremely impressive.
My last question.
I just want a final thought before you go, because I know we're going to close it up a little bit. You talked about legacy. Mm-hmm. You came into it wanting to be greater than your dad. Mm. Tough mission.
Yeah, impossible. Right?
Impossible. Impossible mission. But you are creating a legacy for yourself. And so I'm wondering, as you're navigating through the space, you did nonprofit, now you're in business. You've been in some rooms that most people will never be in. What are some of the biggest lessons that you learn now in the world of business?
I'm worthy. I had a lot of shame.
Self-doubt? Imposter syndrome?
Shame.
Shame for what?
My dad was tough on me. He was tough. I admire him. I'll never catch him. He was tough on me. And I was sensitive. You know, nerdy, goofy, bookish. And he was like a big, you know, like you do. And it made me feel bad about myself. I didn't think I was good enough to be his son. And so I realized I probably spent 30 years trying to overcompensate and improve and do, just trying to catch him, but also to impress him, you know, hey, you know, I may not have been a football player and this type of stuff, but like, I'm all right. I found out later that he was always saying good stuff behind my back. That the whole time he liked me. But he just thought that just cussing me out and pushing me and telling me that that was the way you're supposed to
make a drill sergeant.
Like a drill sergeant. Yeah. He comes out of the military. That's how he's supposed to make a young man. But it hurt my feelings, man.
Yeah. Look at me. There's value in what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I spent a lot of time trying to prove something to him, trying to prove something to myself. But inside, I didn't feel good about myself. I felt, they call it imposter syndrome, but I think that's become too much of a buzzword. I just felt a lot of shame. And so then I'm in these different places and spaces, and I'm not, I'm anxious, man. Like, I would go back to my hotel room, and I'd just cry. You know, I'd go back to my hotel room and have, like, panic attacks. You know, like, did I do okay? Did I say this the right way? Did I say that the right way? You know, was that right? Was that wrong? I mean, just beating myself up, not enjoying any of it. You know, so I'll be on TV, or I get a bestseller, or Emmy, all these different things. Never enjoyed a day of it. I would feel it wasn't enough, or it wasn't deserved. I mean, just a lot of self-flagellation. Getting that $100 million brought even more problems, because then people, you know, want stuff from you. But it did let me take a breath. And I noticed all these guys are getting therapy. All these guys are, you know, using psychedelic therapy, this therapy, that therapy. They did Landmark Forum, Hoffman Institute, Polyvagal, IFS, Internal Family System. All these guys and women were spending time just on themselves, trying to make themselves better, trying to deal with their mommy, daddy issues. And then suddenly they get to a point where they could just take off. And I realized, you know, I was going to put myself in an early grave, because you have insurmountable opportunities, but you also you have insurmountable obstacles. You can also have insurmountable opportunities. You guys are going through that now. The door's just opening and opening and opening and opening. And that can stress you out. And that can also bring a lot of haters and a lot of criticism. And I was going to be in an early grave, man. And so, you know, this summer, I just feel really blessed, because I was able to get some therapeutic help that was useful. I was able to find some my way back to prayer, meditation. I started getting in the gym. You can't tell, but and I would start there. You know, we're worthy. We're worthy to be in these rooms. We're worthy to move capital. We're worthy to imagine whole industries. We're worthy to imagine that every black neighborhood could be Wakanda. That we could drive in, you know, through, you know, cultural renaissance, but also technology transfer and investment. We could make every black neighborhood into Wakanda with the best technology in the world. Every black kid could have an AI tutor better than Harvard, MIT for free. We all of these things, we're worthy to have those dreams, and we're worthy to fight for them, and not just fight for them, just to damn manifest them and say, this is what is going to be in my community. And that's what's available, I think, as an entrepreneur. So much of politics is about the past and the present. You know, reparations is about the past. You know, redistribution is about the present. Oh, we have an income inequality. We got to tax you to give money to her so that she can. And it's all about the past and the present. That's politics, either reparations or redistribution. But the future has not been written. Prince, you say the future is worth fighting for. The future hasn't been written. Why can't these technologies be used for us? Why can't we own the future? Why can't we own that? Why can't we build that? We have the genius. We have the creativity. We have the passion. We have the magic. And now they're giving these magical tools. And this AI stuff is damn near magic. Well, shoot, let's take magical people, use these magical tools, and build a magical future. That's what I'm committed to. The stuff I've learned that has to do with math is not much. You guys are better at that than I am. The stuff that I've learned to do with management is not much. You guys are better at that than I am. But the stuff that I've learned about meaning, the stuff I've learned about me, is priceless, man. And I'm just glad to be here talking all about it.
You're worthy, my dear friend.
Real quick political question. You can answer this in 1 minute. Hmm? Electoral college just seems very stupid to me.
Yes.
At this point in time, and I don't fully understand why it's still even in existence. It helps the Republicans obviously a lot more than Democrats. why we still have the electoral college, and can there ever be a time where you can just get rid of that and just have a one vote? You vote for this thing. If you want him to become president, it goes. Not if I live in New York, my vote doesn't even count. If I vote Republican because it's a Democratic state, or Wyoming, vice versa. It seems like every other country has kind of just revolutionized that and just make it very easy. Can you just give like a 30-second explanation on why this is still in existence?
Well, because just it's hard to change the Constitution in any way that's going to help us. But there is this thing called national popular vote, where if enough state legislatures pass a law that says they're going to give all their electoral votes, because state legislatures can give their electoral votes however they want to. So they all say, if enough of them say, we're going to give our electoral votes to whoever wins the national popular vote, that's an end run around the Constitution, because then they all say, well, look, you can all vote here if you want to, but whoever wins the national vote, that's who we're going to give our electoral college votes to. So there is a way to get it done. It's called national popular vote. You can Google that. But, you know, there's a lot of things in our politics that don't work. But what I notice about black folks is we're the most politically sophisticated people in the country. We know way more about it. You talk to the average black person in a barbershop, knows way more about politics than the average white dude in a bar. I mean, massively more. But we haven't tied that political sophistication to an economic strategy that will get us those trillions of dollars that are going to come down the pipe in the next 10 years. And if we can just take that, we can't fix some parts of the system, but we do have a stronghold. The reason I worry when people say don't vote, say, hold on a second. Let's use what we've got to get what we want. We've got politics. We've got entertainment. Don't give up. Don't throw that in a garbage can and then you have nothing. Use the politics. Use entertainment to get finance and technology. If you can use what you've got and then get what you want, you win the game. And honestly, the fact that we survived 400 years is bullshit, and we're still here in a position where we can make those kind of moves now, is a testament to our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents and their genius, their resolve. They passed us these batons. Don't throw them in the garbage can. Just use them better. That's all I'm saying.
I got a yes or no. It's a yes or no question.
Yeah.
Maximum age limit on elected officials.
There should be some competency. Some competency.
The deep freeze is crazy.
Crazy. It's getting crazy.
The deep freeze is crazy.
Yeah.
Well, pleasure. Thank you. Anything you want to let the audience know before we go?
You know, you guys, you know, 85 South just inspires the heck out of me. You guys just inspire the heck out of me because you came your own way. You came your own way. I came the establishment way to a degree. You know, I went to a fancy law school. I worked for the White House. I'm on CNN. If I was talking to anybody who's a young person today, I would say, do it your way. Don't do it my way, because I'm climbing up institutions that are crumbling. Mm. Cable news is crumbling. You know, the political system is rickety. Like you said, going to spend $1 gazillion to go to private school, education, whatever, that may or may not ever pay off. But if you have a dream, if you believe in something, you can start where you guys started 6 years ago. You were coming to see me. 6 years later, I'm coming to see you. It's like, if you want to understand where the world is going, that right there will tell you. The last time I saw you, you were coming to see me, and I'm sitting here in the lobby trying to come to see you. So that's all I got to say.
There you have it, folks.
Mama made it.
Thank you, guys. Mama made it.
Thank you guys for rocking with us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.